Evans Family Media recently reported that there are two data centers proposed to be constructed here in the Uinta Basin. Now, this story has prompted a lot of response from the community. Good evening, I'm Steve Evans with News Talk KVEL. In an attempt to answer some of these questions raised by many, we've invited Reed Page. Now, Reed is the Director of Gas Operations and Business Development for Summit Energy. We've asked Reed to join us on the air to address some of these questions. Reed, it's good to have you on the air with us.
Yeah, Steve, it's great to be back on. It's been a while.
Tell us a little bit about Summit Energy and your involvement with the project.
Sure, yeah. Summit Energy has been around for about 25 years. It's a regional natural gas marketing and trade company. So we buy and sell physical natural gas commodity. We aggregate and purchase natural gas from independent oil and gas producers throughout the Rockies. And then we handle the transport of those gas volumes through interstate infrastructure, through interstate pipelines, and for delivery into large demand areas like the Wasatch Front through the Enbridge distribution system. We also have customers, commercial and industrial end-use customers in the Uinta Basin, but really in every corner of Utah where Enbridge distributes gas. We are able to flow our physical commodity through their system, through their distribution infrastructure, and deliver it to our customers. So Summit Energy and Enbridge have customers in common. Basically, the same customer will be using Enbridge's pipes to buy Summit's natural gas. So because of what we do, we, in the last 2 years, have seen just a lot of inbound requests from developers of all different types trying to figure out how to build data centers because the power grid is so tapped out, is so behind on being able to meet these massive new demands that they are turning towards on-site power generation behind the meter with natural gas generation equipment, with natural gas reciprocating gensets or even combustion turbines.
So I'm assuming that with the future demand that AI will make on our power grid, this is why the additional power is needed. Is that correct?
In large part, but the grid has just gotten behind anyway because of the narrative around sort of electrify everything. We are just bringing on a lot more sort of organic demand growth just through Utah's continued economic growth and population growth. We just have overall sort of standard power demand that has been growing pretty robustly in the last few years, but then you layer on top of it all of this AI demand, which kind of just blows the rest of it out of the water. I think that your natural demand growth was only maybe a few percent per year. With AI, it's like an extra 7 or 8% per year.
For those who don't understand, the purpose of these data centers is to generate additional power. Is that correct?
The data centers are not there to generate power, but they need lots and lots of power to run the computation, to run the GPUs, the sort of specialized chips that are used for a new type of compute, of AI compute. And it just requires significantly more energy than the old styles of compute that we used to do. But even if it uses 10 times as much energy, its output is like 100 to 1,000 times more robust than what we used to do with computation. So we're able to do things with compute that were just entirely unheard of or unimaginable only about 6 or 7 years ago. But it does require a lot more energy. And this is why these large data center campuses are turning to producing their own power on site with natural gas.
So there'll be a power plant associated with data centers, is that correct?
Correct. That's the most common kind of setup now, is to site a power plant adjacent to the data center itself.
How large will these data centers be, and what is the aesthetic impact on the environment around these data centers?
Well, there is one active project that is producing its own power here in the state of Utah now. They just started operating, they started producing their own power for their new phases. It's called NOVA, N-O-V-V-A, out in West Jordan. Those are, I'm trying to remember now, I think those are, each of those buildings is probably 400,000 square feet, maybe it might be 400,000 or 500,000 square feet. I don't recall off the top of my head, but they're pretty big buildings. Each one of those can house 100 megawatts of chips, approximately. I believe the proposal, and I haven't seen the details of the proposal for Nine Mile, I think that that's probably in the 500 megawatt at least on the power generation side, the on-site power generation side, that they're targeting. But again, don't quote me on this. I'm somewhat familiar with the project, but not directly involved at this point. The buildings are pretty massive. A building that can handle about 300 megawatts, that might be 1 to 1.3 million square feet of data center space.
How much power will they generate again?
They will need to generate enough power to cover their on-site load.
Okay.
So if a data center needs 500 megawatts, they're going to need to build a power plant of about 500 megawatts.
Will it be built bigger than that to accommodate future use?
It's likely that they will simply have space adjacent. Like they'll design the site so that you can have expansion capacity.
Okay.
So you can build a later phase building, for example. But they will still have to layer on more power generation.
Reed Page, where is the proposed location of these two data centers?
I'm not sure on the second one. I haven't heard a whole lot of detail on the second, but the one that I am aware of, the 9 Mile Data Center that was run through the Planning Commission last week, that's going to be set up on the South Mighton Bench.
Okay.
To the southwest of the city of Mighton.
What will be the impact on our power grid if new energy is not generated?
If new energy is not generated?
Yes.
Well, one, new energy has to be generated. It just has to, because it takes too many years to get a grid interconnection, for one. We're talking very long lead times to get connected to high voltage transmission lines. But two, if at some point there is an interconnection made with high voltage, the impact to rates and ratepayers it's a little bit up in the air. It really depends, in my opinion, on what type of entity is operating that transmission. For us out in the basin, I think it's, in this case, is very fortunate that Deseret, I believe Deseret Power, Deseret Generation and Transmission, was the system that was targeted in the application for CUP. If the project can make a deal with Deseret and therefore with Moon Lake Electric, which is the load serving entity in that territory, they have the service territory for this, I am pretty confident that they'll be able to make a useful deal that is helpful to the local grid. It won't necessarily raise costs. It's very difficult to just assume how it's going to impact rates, but just rest assured that Deseret and Moon Lake Electric, they're extremely, extremely committed to doing things that are right for the ratepayers and for the members and owners of the co-op.
That leads to another question, Reed Page. What about the end consumer? Will the power bills of individuals increase versus if we don't have a data center? What will the power bills look like there if that much demand is on the grid?
Power costs kind of only go up over time, no matter what. Power costs are likely to continue going up and may accelerate just a little bit. It may outpace inflation, in my opinion. It probably will outpace inflation. And then lastly, if you do have a data center in your area, it depends on how it interconnects and how it interacts with your local grid. It's debatable how an interconnection with the Deseret and the Moon Lake Electric system would impact ratepayers in the Uinta Basin. Now, if you're in Vernal, it may not affect you at all because you're served by Rocky Mountain Power. It may or may not. But it's very, very, it's such a complex question that there is no simple answer that is accurate.
You would assume that more power available would actually not affect the power costs for commercial or residential use.
Maybe.
Right?
Yeah, maybe. If they are bringing a power plant that interacts with the grid, that is able to sell its excess into the grid when the on-site load does not require it, that can be very helpful. You also add, when it links up to the high voltage system, it actually contributes to the stability and the quality of the power going across the grid regionally. So sometimes by adding both a combination of load and generation, you can actually strengthen the grid for everybody and improve its reliability. Generally, what the transmission operator is going to target is something that is useful to their entire system and to ratepayers.
Reed Page, what about the environmental impacts? It's been stated in some of the commentary online that there will be required about 1.5 million gallons per day. Is that an accurate figure, or how much water will be needed to operate a data center, including reclamation?
Yeah, this is a great question, and this is probably the biggest, most pressing question on everybody's mind is how much water is this thing going to use, and power and everything else is sort of secondary to this question, especially in a year like what we're having. That number, I mean, it's kind of a made up number online. I think it was just a comment that was made, but it's rooted in a kernel of truth from data center construction from the last like 20 years. In the past, data centers used to use evaporative cooling in their cooling systems to keep the computers cool, to keep the servers cool. They no longer can do that because there's so much energy density and so much heat coming off of them that you just can't do it anymore. You can cool a chainsaw, right, with air, but you can't cool, you know, a 400 horsepower BMW engine with just air or with evaporative cooling, with a swamp cooler. You have to use closed loop liquid cooling that circulates and rejects heat through a radiator. And that is the direction that all of these data centers have gone to, is closed loop cooling. So they're essentially zero water consumption. There's some that have a little bit of water consumption under the most dire circumstances, but the design and the construction that they've gone to has really gone to zero water consumption on the cooling side, not just because of water scarcity, but mostly because of physics and thermodynamics. So I would say that 1.5 million number is really made up. It's a made up number. It's not really rooted in truth here for the design that I think they're probably going to use. The other thing too is any water that they will be consuming is mostly going to be for potable culinary use. It's going to be for the personnel that are there on site. And it could be anywhere from 5,000 gallons a day, 10,000 gallons a day, depending again on how many full-time employees are there. It could be up to 15,000 gallons a day, but that might be less than half of the water consumption of your local high school.
I see.
On a
okay.
daily basis.
All right. So the water, so the water consumption is pretty minimal in compared to some of the comments that have been made online. What about fuel source?
Correct.
What fuel source will operate the generators? For example, DG&T uses coal. What will be the fuel source to operate the generators to generate this electricity?
For this project, from what I've read and what I see in the application, the target is for natural gas fired generation. I'm not sure which technology they are working, you know, are trying to use or design to, whether it's combustion turbines or reciprocating engines. But we're seeing both of those selections at large data center projects all over the country. And so either way, it's natural gas is your primary fuel. And, you know, you spin something and you make electricity with it. You just do it at very, very, very large scale. So, yeah, natural gas is the choice. And fortunately for us in the Uinta Basin, we have quite a bit of natural gas to go around, more than we need to take the natural gas that otherwise is worth not so much and is difficult even to market and to get to more valuable markets. It makes a lot of sense to do a value-added process within the Uinta Basin. To take that primary energy source and turn it into something much more valuable that is actually quite easy to export over, you know, fiber lines. And so when you think of a data center, you can think of it as like a factory that takes raw data in, combines it with energy and processing, and then outputs what you would consider like refined data. It's very similar to an oil refinery, but of course we're talking data, ones and zeros.
Speaking of natural gas usage, what will this the extra consumption of natural gas do to our ozone attainment and EPA permitting?
So any project like this is obligated, is required to receive air permits because they're going to be producing their own power on site. They'll be working through the Utah Department of Air Quality, who administers the new source review process. And so because we're in ozone non-attainment, right now we're still classified as marginal. There is a 100 tons per year limit for nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds. Those are both ozone precursors. And so they will have to show compliance with those. If they go up and over those tonnage thresholds, they'll have to do additional extra legwork to get themselves back underneath that threshold. And that might have to do with, you know, changing your run schedules or maybe just sizing down the project to a certain degree, but they will have to meet those criteria. They have to meet those thresholds and get fully permitted under the Clean Air Act, which is an EPA reg that is administered at the state level by DAQ. Anytime you're making anything, you are going to create new emissions, anytime you're producing power, you are going to create a new set of emissions, but they will have to be fully compliant with their control technologies and their emission controls.
How are these projects going to be funded? Will local taxpayer dollars be used?
Yeah, that is a common concern. In the past, some municipalities back east in particular have taken a little bit more risk upon themselves to finance some of the infrastructure to try and invite these types of projects in into their communities because they see the possibility of, you know, huge property tax revenues coming in, which is true. What we're seeing now is these projects are not going to be relying so much on local incentives or special deals, right, on the taxpayer, on the backs of the taxpayers. They're really, really focused on, can we get this project off the ground? Can we get our political approvals, our entitlements, whether it's a conditional use permit or rezoning? And is there enough energy available in this location and labor force? Are all the other boxes being checked on the infrastructure side? And that's where they just don't rely on local support directly in terms of taxpayer dollars. These projects get papered up. They get financed on capital markets. So they're not meant to be financed by taxpayers. They're meant to be financed by the cash flows of the project itself. And there are some unique mechanisms here in the state of Utah, particularly the Utah Inland Port Authority, which I believe all this acreage has already been amended into a Utah Inland Port Authority project area, Black Gold. And the UIPA process and the UIPA tax increment finance structures are extremely unique. And in my opinion, they're very, very, very helpful, both to the community and to the developer themselves, for a whole list of reasons that are a little bit complex. And generally, you need to be at a whiteboard or have some visual aids to help walk through them. But no, I guess to put a fine point on it, no, this is not meant to be built on the back of taxpayers.
What about supporting infrastructure, transmission lines, substations, roads, right-of-ways into the facility? We'll start with transmission lines. What type of investment is going to be made there, and is that a whole new permitting process that needs to happen, or can it be tied into existing transmission lines?
Again, speaking in generality, because I'm not directly inside of this project, but I did see their application. Projects like these, if they do need to build transmission lines to interconnect with other regional transmission, mm-hmm. they need to pay for it themselves, right? Or they'll work out some sort of a payment, some sort of a structured finance deal to get that type of infrastructure built for themselves. And so this is infrastructure that wouldn't be put up if not for this project, and therefore the project needs to pay for it over time. So that's just on the high voltage transmission side. On the pipeline side, it's exactly the same. The pipe has to be financed by the project in order to get interconnected with the high pressure interstate pipelines.
So to emphasize, no additional local resources, our taxes aren't going to go up to pay for this project.
Correct. Now, that's the intention, right? I'm going to say we'll be leaving that up to our public officials to ensure that they are haggling, that they're making the best deal for the public, right? And not taking any risks, any undue risks with public funds, public resources. And I think we have a great group of people that are up there making these deals, at least in Duchesne County.
Do we have the support from the governor's office?
I'm not sure about the governor's office. The governor's office doesn't generally just kind of go out and make blanket approval statements for projects. But I will say that the governor's office has messaged for the state that the state of Utah is open for business. And they have continuously messaged their support for the right projects in the right places, subject, obviously, to local land use authority approval and municipal and county participation in the whole process. So if it's a good project, the governor's office is going to be very, very supportive, especially as much as it supports kind of the larger American narrative of being the compute capital kind of the world and the, I could say, the race with China to get ahead in the AI race.
You know, a big question here, Reed Page, is what about the economic impact? How many jobs will be created both through the construction period and post-construction period?
The construction period is where you will see it's kind of front-loaded. You'll see a lot of jobs come in for construction. I think this is going to be a little bit this is going to feel a little similar to like railroad conversations. Is there's going to be a lot of people out there building these huge structures for a few years, and then once you're fully built out, maybe there's multiple phases over the course of, you know, 5 or 6 years. I don't know what's been proposed. But you will see an influx of hundreds of jobs, many hundreds, maybe even closer to 1,000 jobs in the construction of a campus of this size, especially since there's also a solar aspect to it. There's an extra few hundred jobs, probably. So during your construction phases, you could have lots and lots and lots of jobs. But during your operational phase, it narrows quite a bit down. You might have just a few hundred people on that campus. Generally speaking, projects like this will end up with a few hundred high-paying jobs, high-paying like over $115,000 per year.
And what about the timeline?
So this depends a lot on whether the project can find a capital partner that wants to build this thing all the way up. So as soon as a project like this reaches final investment decision and there is a full cast of characters, the partners and the capital involved, the target is usually to have your first phase up and running within 2 years of shovels in the ground.
Okay, so relatively soon.
If they were to get shovels in the ground a year from now, if possible, and that would be really amazing if they did, then you should be in production 2 years from that point.
Okay.
Maybe three, just because generators now have these incredibly long lead times. Substation equipment and transformers are way, way out on lead times. So we're a few years away from first power. But I'd like to go back to economic impact.
Okay.
If you would, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Because we only talked about jobs. We did not talk about property taxes. And when you look at the value of a campus of this size, let's just assume that it's 500 megawatts. We see something like, let's just use the heuristics that we see. $12 million per megawatt of capacity goes into building just the building and the cooling system and the power system. And this excludes the power plant itself. So call it a $600 million per build of this set of buildings. Then you will load it with computer chips that are worth probably about twice that, probably about $1.2 billion worth. Actually, my numbers might be off by a whole order of magnitude. But you're $5.2 billion, I guess, on your building construction for 500 megawatts worth. Then it's about $10 billion worth of microchip go into these buildings. All of this is subject to property tax or personal property tax. So there's either real property tax or personal property tax. And depending on how all of this gets financed, whether it's with tax increment finance through UIPA or through specific negotiations through the different taxing authorities, taxing entities in Duchesne County, you will likely see something like in the tens of millions of dollars in new property tax revenue coming into the county that could go into the general fund. And not seeing all the details of the project, but it is likely to be in that sort of scale, in the tens of millions of dollars that gets returned to the county during a tax increment finance period, which I assume is going to happen because they're part of UIPA. And then when this kind of period ends, all property tax, all personal property tax will then be fully returned to the county once a lot of this infrastructure is paid off over the course of 10 or 15 or 20 years. Then you're left with many, many tens of millions of dollars left in the county. And to me, I think that's transformative, considering the fact that so much of our impact, of the impacts to our infrastructure in Duchesne County, are because of oil and gas operations, oftentimes not on federal ground, on private and tribal and state ground, which is subject to severance tax, which does not fully come back to Duchesne County. And so it creates some challenges. On federal royalties, federal oil and gas leases, more of it does come back through CIB money. But because so much of our more recent production growth has been on non-federal lands, we've ended up with this outsized impact from extractive industry that has not been fully made up by severance taxes. I think that a project like this one, like this data center and potentially the second, wherever that one is, would be absolutely transformative for Duchesne County in terms of revenue available for the general fund, for providing public services, potentially even reducing people's property taxes to their homes. That is a very real conversation.
Wow.
In many of these communities throughout the state of Utah. They never, ever reduce your property taxes, but this type of a project will make that possible.
All right. Reed Page, are there any final comments that you'd like to make before we bring this discussion to a close?
Sure. I'd like to say I'm supportive of these projects. I think that they can be done well. I do trust in the people In our public schools. I no longer live in Duchesne County, but I am very, very close. I'm still out there for business purposes, and I visit frequently for DAGM meetings. And I am still in very close contact with elected officials and the people who are in charge of taking care of the community and fighting for the benefit of members of the community out there. And I am confident that they will be able to hold these projects accountable to what they promise, and they'll be able to make the types of deals and that make sense for the community and can be transformative to the community. So, you know, I'm here to support these types of projects in every corner of the state of Utah where it makes some sense. But I'm also willing to be realistic about the impacts and to go right into detail when anyone asks me about them. Consider me a resource. Anybody out there, if you want to get a hold of me, you can.
How do we do that?
Well, call me on my cell phone. I guess it's been a while since I've given my cell phone over the air. But
do you want to do it? I don't know. Be careful.
I don't care. I'm still the Rocky Mountain Energy Economist, and anybody that has questions is welcome to give me a call and just ask me how these things work. But you call me on my cell phone, and I'll answer. 435-659-9084.
Reed Page, Director of Gas Operations and Business Development with Summit Energy. Reed, thank you for taking the time to come in and visit with us about this important subject. It is important to the future economic growth of our area, and the legitimate questions that the public has, I think deserve an honest and open response. And so thank you for providing that to the community.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
All right, I'm Steve Evans with Evans Family Media here on News Talk KVEL. Thanks for joining us.